Let's turn to Genesis 39, and if you don't have an outline, raise your hand. You'll want to get one of those. If you're visiting with us, we are in a series in the book of Genesis. The section we're in now, the final section, we're calling Evil to Good. It's usually known as the life of Joseph. But there's a lot more happening than just a focus on Joseph. So I want to begin with what may appear to be a very general question, but I think is really fundamental to understanding what's happening in this chapter. And this is the question. Don't answer it out loud. Just, if you would, think about it. Does God love you? And I mean by that more than just is the right answer on a theology test, but does God love you? Like, is he for you? Is he with you? Does he work all things for your good and his glory? Is he at work today for you? Because he loves you. And I know it's easy just to say, yeah, I know I'm supposed to say the right answer is yeah. But I don't know why. And if you're confused about why God would love you, you're in a good place. Because if your answer as to why God loves you is anything other than because, you may not understand the love of God. Like, there isn't an answer to why God loves us other than because he does. Because out of the delight of God overflows affection for you. Like, how do you explain that? Why he would love puny, weak, sinful people and love them so much that he manifests his love in the giving of his son. So that gets to the question of how do we know that he loves us? Because he gave his son for us. He gave his son for us, who died to pay for every sin we have and will ever commit. He defeated sin and death on the cross and rose from the grave. And he gives us his spirit who dwells within us and bears witness that we are his and that he loves us. So does God love you? The question, does God love you, has everything to do with how we think about temptation, has everything to do with how we think about injustice, how we think about suffering. And I want us to listen and read the Genesis 39, thinking about that question. Like, what is the theme of Genesis 39? What are some repeated phrases, statements, words that seem to communicate that theme? So, David Heath is going to read this chapter. And as he does, listen carefully, look carefully for repeated phrases for what is the theme of this chapter. Genesis 39.
Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house, and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had, in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house." Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home, and she told him the same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came in to me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house." As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, "This is the way your servant treated me," his anger was kindled, and Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed.
Any repeated phrases that might highlight the theme of the chapter? Yeah, the beginning of the chapter, twice, the Lord was with him. Chapter ends, even after Joseph does the right thing and pays dearly, the text still emphasizes the Lord was with him. There are also sprinkled throughout statements that are similar. The Lord blessed him. The Lord blessed Potiphar because of him. The Lord caused all that he did to succeed. You know, there are these clear statements, and even more directly, verse 21, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love." I mean, this is the theme of Genesis 39, is this steadfast, faithful presence of God with Joseph. But even as we focus on that theme, and we're going to give our attention to that, but we want to be aware of the fact that this isn't just about Joseph, even though the immediate story focuses in on him. We actually, in this chapter, see seeds of fulfillment of Genesis 12. Do you remember Genesis 12 is the hinge of Genesis? And really launches us into the entire message of the Bible, where God came to Abraham and made his promise to Abraham that I will bless you, and through you and your family, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And in this chapter, you get seeds coming to fruition, just little seeds coming to fruition in the life of Joseph. Look, for example, at verse 5, "From that time he made him overseer in his house, and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field." I mean, that is an allusion to Genesis 12, that because Joseph is Abraham's great-great-grandson, God's blessing is flowing through him and is affecting other people. is other people are being blessed because of him. Also, the shape of the chapter points us forward to the ultimate Joseph. Affliction. I'm sorry, exaltation, humiliation, exaltation. Do you see the shape? It starts with exaltation. Joseph is exalted to the head of Potiphar's home. Then it moves through humiliation, and then the chapter ends with, even in prison, he is exalted. That, what I often call gospel U, is the exaltation of Christ, the humiliation, service, servant, death of Christ, resurrection, exaltation of Christ. You'll see that shape in the gospel flow all through the Bible, but ultimately culminating in Jesus Christ. So even though this is a story about Joseph, it is much bigger than that. This is the promise of God being fulfilled in Joseph's life, but then extending beyond Joseph to the nations of the world. We want to keep that in mind whenever we look at Genesis 39. But for the sake of time, and because we've been talking a lot about that, I want us to focus in on one aspect of this chapter, one part of the theme of this chapter. And that is simply the question, how does God's faithful presence, which is obvious in Genesis 39, help us fight temptation? Another way to ask that question is, how is Genesis 39 different from 38? Did you feel like you had to go home and take a shower after Genesis 38 last week? I mean, it is a nasty chapter. And yet, God's faithfulness, as we saw last week, shines through Genesis 38. But it shines through in spite of Judah. What we're going to see in Genesis 39 is God's faithfulness likewise shines through, but it shines through Joseph's faithfulness. That actually the faithfulness of God is now being incarnated in one of his people, which is just so encouraging. And it's interesting that God puts these two stories right next to each other for that reason. So how does God's faithful presence help us fight temptation? Three ways. Number one, God's presence calls. Calls. We are no longer victims. See, Genesis 39 picks up where Genesis 37 left off. Joseph was on his way to Egypt. He is now in Egypt. He is sold to Potiphar. He is a slave. And no doubt he is spending a lot of his time doing menial tasks. And don't fly over that. Let me give you a quick timeline. Joseph was how old when he was sold by his brothers? 17, Genesis 37 tells us. We know from Genesis 41 that Joseph is 30 when he is raised into the service of Pharaoh. We know that Joseph spent at least 2 years in prison before being called out. At least 2 years. So there's about 10 or 11 years where Joseph arrives as a 17-year-old in fetters, sold to Potiphar, doesn't know the language, doesn't know the customs, has no management experience, but somehow over those 10 or 11 years, learns Egyptian, learns the customs, becomes acquainted with a host of managerial skills that he would have needed to do what he is doing in Genesis 39. So, don't skim over that. Like, at least a decade where he is stumbling along as a slave, doing menial tasks, and yet, what Genesis 39 at the beginning is emphasizing is that the presence of God in Joseph changed the way he lived that calling as a slave. You see that? We know that time included deep suffering. For example, Psalm 105, verse 18, referring to Joseph, says his feet were hurt with fetters, his neck was put in a collar of iron. Now, this could refer to what's still to come when he gets thrown in prison, or when he was being transported down to Egypt, either one. But the point is, much of his experience at this time included pain, suffering, abuse, neglect, and he could have very easily embraced a victim mentality and slipped into deep bitterness toward his brothers. Like, humanly speaking, I have no idea how he didn't. I hate my brothers. I would not be doing what I'm doing now. I would not be in shackles if it wasn't for those jerks. You know, can you imagine the bitterness? Can you imagine the anger, and then how that would begin to affect him? And how do you learn a new language and learn all these customs, and you're with people you don't even know, and you're being told what you have to do all day long? So somehow, in the midst of this suffering and rejection, God's presence enables Joseph to thrive in really difficult circumstances. And this is one of the great miracles. To think about this. Because think about us. We don't naturally do that. When we experience disappointment or hurt, we are far more vulnerable to temptation. Right? The innocent partner who has a spouse who has been unfaithful is more likely, statistically, to plunge into immorality. The single man who is angry at God for wiring him a particular way with a same-sex struggle, or not giving him a spouse in the timing that he longs to have one, is far more prone to plunge into pornography. The young teen who is angry at her father is far more likely to move toward depression, addiction, and immorality. Johnny Erickson Tada talked about a couple weeks ago, you remember the video clip, the interview I showed you, where what it was like for her after being paralyzed and just hating the thought of sitting in a wheelchair, spending her life in a wheelchair. She went into deep depression. And she prayed a prayer at that time, as she shared, Lord, if I can't die, teach me how to live. And God began answering that prayer. And she even later used the word steward, stewardship. She began to view her life in a wheelchair, her inabilities, her disabilities, as a calling, a vocation, a stewardship. We don't use that word much now, but it's an opportunity to supervise or manage something that has been entrusted to my care. As Piper would say, don't waste your pain. Like, God entrusts us. And what Joseph is illustrating here is the very thing that he could have used to justify anything became because of the presence of God in his life. Because of the steadfast, he had an understanding of the steadfast love that did not conclude, if bad things happen to me, God must not love me. Like, he flipped that. If bad things happen to me, God is up to something really good that I right now can't feel or see. I know that sounds crazy. And it's not just a mind game. It's not just positivity thinking. The Lord was with Joseph. And God's presence in his life, his steadfast love in his life, gave him a calling. Number two, we'll come back to that. Number two, God's presence clarifies. Not only calls, it also clarifies. In the midst of temptation, in the midst of suffering, we are no longer deceived. You see, in temptation, we are often tempted by the reason to say no becomes the reason to say yes to temptation. I know that's confusing. I know you lost an hour of sleep, so I'll go over this. You think about it. When we are tempted, there are reasons that make that temptation seem reasonable. Like, if you notice, verses 3 through 6 use the word all 5 times. All that he hadn't, all that he hadn't, all that he hadn't, all that he hadn't, all that he had. Like, 5 times. The point is, Joseph had been entrusted with everything in regards to Potiphar. And so now his wife comes along and says, have me. So logically, you're thinking, wait a second, Joseph, you're taking care of all the money, right? All the food, all the resources, the field, the house, the management, the accounting. You're doing everything for Potiphar. He's out on the golf course all day long, hanging out at the pyramids. You know, he's essentially doing nothing. And it makes sense. If you have everything, why not her? Why don't you get her? See, that's how temptation works, right? I mean, you have everything. Why not? It makes sense. So in that sense, the reason to say no, she's his wife, becomes the reason to say yes. I have everything else. Why not her? And I'm sure she, based on the wording here, was adding credibility to that line of thinking. You know, my husband doesn't listen to me. He's never around. He's always, you know, married to the next Pharaoh promotion. He just cares about his job. Like, no man has ever understood me like you. I mean, all these lines, everything. My husband doesn't deserve me. You do. And it makes sense. Why not? Remember, Adam and Eve were tempted with a similar proposition. Every tree in the garden you can eat of, but one. Why not that one? Like, if we can eat of every tree of the garden, which one do we want to, except one, which one do we want to eat of? Yeah, don't tell me no. Look at everything but that. Don't look at the red curtain. You fail. Yeah, that's how we're wired. So when Joseph, you have everything, why not her? So when you're in that kind of 500 shades of gray, and it all gets washed together, and there seems like, and especially the Egyptian culture was no different from ours, immorality was completely acceptable. When it all gets washed together, how do you distinguish between right and wrong? And wrong becomes right. Like, it actually feels wrong to not do the wrong. Like, I'm not being true to myself. I'm lying to myself and everyone else. For the first time in my life, I have to be honest about who I am. I'm done being a legalist. All these boundaries. You give me a boundary, I'll show you a boundary. And look at the way Joseph responds. This is a massive miracle that illustrates the difference when we live in the loving, faithful presence of God. Look what he says, verse 7. After a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself. Because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Right in the middle of the moral fog is a bright light. This is not about two consenting adults. This is about great wickedness before God. And this light that flows not from some kind of legalistic, I've got to do something or God's going to fry me, but I live in the steadfast love of God. He has been faithful to me. How can I do this wickedness against God? And how can I do this wickedness against your husband? There is wrong and there is right. And the only thing that will give you that kind of clarity is if you're living in the presence of God. Because we live in a culture and we have hearts that are always moving. Everything's shifting, constantly moving. And it all gets washed together. God says in Psalm 36, verse 9, the psalmist says, "In your light do we see light." It's very interesting. We can't even distinguish light from darkness without the light of God. And that's what I mean by God's presence clarifies. It gives us eyes to see. Psalm 119, 104, "Through your precepts I get understanding. Therefore, I hate every false way. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. Otherwise, I'm stumbling. I'm just making my way through life, opportunity after opportunity, and eventually I will fall off the cliff because I can't see clearly. What gives me clarity? It is living in the light of your love. Removes the fog. Heals the cataracts. God's presence clarifies. Number three, God's presence compels. It calls Joseph. It clarifies right and wrong, truth and error for Joseph. And number three, God's presence compels him, constrains him, empowers him, energizes him. We are no longer powerless. How does this work? Well, temptation comes in waves. It is extremely flexible. Have you noticed that? That when you're being tempted, the first volley is usually fairly easy to repel and identify and repel. But then what the enemy does is he knows that once we've resisted something, we can either be proud of the fact that we said no or deceived at the alternative versions of the temptation. So what the enemy does is he comes at us from multiple angles. Temptation is malleable, flexible, always morphing, modifying. Like a virus to get in your computer, never comes directly, usually won't get in, but it comes in different forms. Look at the variety of forms this temptation comes to Joseph. First of all, Potiphar's wife begins to entice him. Verse 7, "Lie with me." Her eyes fall on him. The eyes are a big part of that. She's not aggressive at this point. She's seeking to allure him, to break down his defenses. The eyes are a big theme because Egyptian women were the first women to use eye makeup. It was a big deal in that culture. So she casts her eyes on him to get his attention, to entice him, to draw him. At this point, we don't know if he's somewhere between 17, 18, more likely 25 to 30, somewhere in there, a young man. This is a tender enticement. But then to entice goes another level, to erode, another form, to erode his defenses. Verse 10, when he said no, she spoke to Joseph, you see that, day after day, day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her, to be with her. Now in our case, we're free to come and go, we're free to quit a job, keep a job. Joseph was not free. He was still a slave. In many ways, he didn't have a choice. He had to stay there. So the temptation was that much more difficult because he had to face it every day. Many of our temptations are similar. They're things we can't get away from. Some things we can get away from. Other temptations live in our heads and are part of our work. And day after day after day, the enemy seeks to erode our resistance. Other temptations are invited. Some of us watch television shows and purchase movies that do just what Potiphar's wife was doing to Joseph, except we do it voluntarily. Like bringing it on as if watching night after night movies about men and women, or men and men, or women and women being unfaithful to God and to each other is not going to wear us down or have any effect on us. What seemed repulsive becomes acceptable. And this was Potiphar's wife's goal. I will conquer him. He will not say. She's a very powerful woman in a powerful position and most likely very attractive and is not used to hearing no. And so Joseph's no simply invites a new form of the attack. And she is persistent. And some of us start imagining at this point, well, if God did not want me to succumb to this temptation, he would have taken it away. So he must have made me this way. Oh, really? Seeks to erode, finally to entrap. The temptation goes to another level in verse 11, but one day when he went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. So now we have a ratcheting up of the temptation, a little more intense. Joseph at this point has to take radical, evasive maneuvers. He flees. And he loses another coat. This dude is worse than a 7-year-old at a recess. Like... keeps losing coats. It's a theme throughout this story. But I love that this is a classic Matthew Henry. Better to lose a good coat than a good conscience. Just think about that for a minute. Do we believe that? You could fill in a bunch there, couldn't you? What else could you put in there? Better to lose a good job than a good conscience. What else? Better to lose a good friend. There are times when you will have to say no, and it will cost you a friend. But you will keep a clean conscience before God because you're living in the presence of God. It's not that you're a Pharisee saying, I'm better than you. which is the way it will be interpreted almost 100% of the time. Better to lose a good... What else? Good. Grade. That. That's funny, because I was just listening to a college student just this week say, cheating is rampant. Like, it is the way you make it through school. If you do your own work, you're viewed as an idiot. And you have to actually work in school. So that's a good one. Hadn't thought of that. Better to lose a good grade than a good conscience. So think about it for your life. Right now, what are you tempted by? Better to lose a good blank than a good conscience. Franklin Jones says, what makes resisting temptation difficult for many people is that they don't want to discourage it completely. Isn't that true? Like, I want to say no because I don't want to feel guilty, but I like having it around. Like, just over here in case I'm really lonely or really bored or... So I don't discourage it completely. I don't want to burn the bridge. Better to lose a good computer than a good conscience. We don't want to discourage it completely. This is what Jesus meant, I think, when he said, if your hand offends you, cut it off. I offend you, pluck it out. He's not talking about physically maiming yourself, but what he's getting at is the same thing Joseph is illustrating. What is more valuable to you? And are we taking temptation seriously? The presence of God empowers Joseph to refuse to cave in under relentless attack. And if you think, well, if I do the right thing, God will bless me. Look what happened to Joseph. He got shafted big time. Potiphar's wife made up a story that he was the one that was attacking her, and she screamed, left his coat, he ran out. You wonder if Potiphar really believed his wife. He seemed angry, according to the text, but... In that day, attempted rape was a capital offense. He's a slave. No doubt he would have been killed. Potiphar doesn't execute him. Who knows? She may have actually believed him. He may have actually believed Joseph more than his wife. We don't know. But the point is, it's the presence of God that compels us. You know, most of us, if you read the story of Joseph like you're reading it for the first time, you're going to be like, no way. No way. And it's true. Humanly speaking, it's impossible. Especially in an age where hormones reign, define us, dominate our lives, dominate entertainment, dominate our culture. They are God. And here's a young man who's saying, no, the Lord is God. His steadfast love is better than life. It is better than a job. It is better than a promotion. It is better than what people think of me. It is better. So how do we process this? I know there's a lot in these three, so I wanted to ask some questions that you can continue to meditate on this week with your shepherding group, with your family, with your spouse or friend. So let's summarize what we've seen here. Number one, God's presence calls us. And what we mean by that is that stewardship, that in the midst of this suffering, there is an opportunity somewhere. And we may not even be able to see it. Please don't think I'm just trying to put a bow on this thing, because for Joseph, it didn't go well for him in chapter 39. But what have you experienced that tends to leave you feeling like a victim perpetually? Could be a disappointment with God, a feeling of rejection, abandonment. In what ways does that feeling of hurt or disappointment leave you vulnerable to anger, to despair, to lust? Remember, sin carpools. And one leads to another. If Joseph hadn't gone to God with his hurt, he would not have been able to go to God in his temptation. And so then one thing snowballs into another. So if God's presence calls us in the midst of suffering, what does this stewardship, this calling, this opportunity to manage what the Lord has entrusted to us look like for you? I know it sounds crazy. Joseph saw his unfortunate situation as a calling from God. And he actually was blessing the people who were holding him in slavery. Now, this isn't Stockholm Syndrome, where someone who's abused begins to gain affection for their abuser. That's not what we're talking about here. That's a perversion. This is out of confidence for the steadfast love of God. I may hate what I'm experiencing, the pain I'm experiencing. I hate that. We're not trying to make that something good, but I am confident that God is up to something good. That's different. And in that calling, I'm waking up in the morning with a sense that God is up to something in my life and through my life. Do you live with that sense? I can't live without it. I know I deny it all the time, and I have to constantly get on my face and go back to the promises of God, but I can't live without it. If I'm just floating through my day, I'm not going to make it. There are too many alternative distractions and affections. God is calling you with His love. Don't put Joseph in a glass container and stick him to the side. He's doing this in you. He has sent His Son, who is the great grandson of Joseph. This big story of God is unfolding before our eyes, and we're part of it. This last week, my kids and I were reviewing some Proverbs verses they learned when they were tiny, and just while we were eating dinner, and one of the verses was Proverbs 12:24. I think this is New King James. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor. We had a really good talk about what that means. Like, what does it mean to live your life under the rule of somebody? It might be a teacher or a boss or a spouse and the more they come down on you, the digger you deep. Digger the dog, he will go with you. The deeper you dig, and what happens? The deeper you dig, the harder the authority seems to come down on you. And it hurts, and I want to get out, so you dig deeper. You try to evade, and some people live their whole lives that way. Some of them end up in jail where they're told what to do all day long. Some of them work jobs like that. What he's saying is the hand of the diligent will rule. It's not that you're throwing off people. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. But the authority is no longer the authority that drives you is no longer this human authority. There's something that happens within you. That's what the Proverbs is talking about by diligent. There's an internal motivation from the Spirit of God that where you're rising above that authority. Not that you're saying off with all authority, but that there's something in you like Joseph. Nobody's telling him to get up in the morning and go to work. Like there's the presence of God, the love of God is fueling him. So any sort of authority is asking less of him. Because of that energizing grace, that favor of God. That is, so the hand of the diligent will bear rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor. Stop running! Run to God. Tap into that energizing favor that fuels us. Number two, God's presence doesn't just call. We saw that God's presence clarifies. Clarifies. We become worshipers in the sense that we live in His presence and sin is against Him, not just a human thing. So can you think of a temptation you face where the reason to say no to temptation actually can become the reason to say yes? Like where Joseph had been entrusted with everything, so why not her? This may take more time. You may think of something right away or you may need some weeks to pray about that. But are there times where you feel the reason to say no has flipped and it's become the reason to say yes? Or again, where those saying no actually feels wrong? Why are these kinds of temptations difficult to resist? Well, because they seem to be right, right? So how does God's presence clarify the right and the wrong in these temptations? Really what we're asking there is like when God shines His love in our minds, how does that light dispel the lies that we are so prone to believe? That word that becomes a light to our path. Dispelling the darkness. That's a beautiful study in and of itself. And thirdly, we learn that God's presence compels it. We are overcomers. Temptation is persistent and adaptable. Can you identify several forms of the same temptation you face? Which form is most difficult for you to resist? Why? I think it's helpful for us to be aware of that. And then why, in a context of suffering and temptation, is God described as the God of all grace? 1 Peter 5:10. And by all there, He doesn't just mean volume. Like He has huge amounts of grace, which all means all there. Lots of grace, but it also means not just quantity, but specificity. You ever go to TJ Maxx and you just got to get a pair of pants and they're on sale and the one pair that they don't have is always your size. Like that's how we often feel in temptation. Like if you're the God of all grace, like I really need some grace right now. And what Peter is saying, He is the God not only of all amounts of grace, but He is the God of all kinds of grace. His size fits your temptation. He has grace specifically designed for your time of need. And that's why the Bible in 1 Corinthians 10 can say He has the way of escape for you in the midst of temptation, because He doesn't deal in generalities. He provides specific forms of grace for specific forms of attack. Because temptation is malleable and remakes itself constantly. And God's grace is fitting the shape of our temptation. He is the God of all grace. All kinds of grace. And so if you allow yourself to think through what is the shape of his temptation in my life right now, God is saying, I have that kind of grace. It's on sale. It's actually free right now through Jesus. He is faithful. He will provide a way to escape. That whole verse in 1 Peter 10 says, after you have suffered a little while, the God of all grace, who has called you. So Peter goes to the same place as Joseph. You are called in the midst of that suffering to his eternal glory in Christ. He will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. So, let's respond to him. And I know you're going to need time, and I hope you will take time this week to process those questions. We've just kind of flew through them. But for right now, let's go back to the song that we heard right before the message. Think about what it's like to walk step by step with the Lord. To know that all his ways are loving and faithful.